Hello and welcome to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Elise. Today, our guest is fiber artist Helena Hernmark. Hernmark was born in 1941 and grew up in Sweden. As a young woman, she decided that she would dedicate her artistic life to a beautiful, complex, and often unknown art, weaving. After graduating from art school in 1963, she moved to Canada, England, and finally the US in the mid-70s. That's where she has been working as an artist, producing tapestries, including commissions for large-scale projects. While she lives in the US, she maintains strong ties with her home country. Every year, she returns to Sweden to pick and dye the yarn that she then uses on her tapestries. Hernmark's work is renowned throughout the United States and the world. She weaves the way some paint, bringing light, intensity, and depth to the unusual feeling of yarn. Her work often covers walls at a time, and her latest project took 4 years to be realized. Earlier this month, she talked with Colette Laboeuf about her work. Let's dive right into their conversation.
It sounds like, and I hope we can talk about this a little bit, you have rich collaborations with people.
Yes, I do. And it's become more, really, since my husband passed away in 2013.
Okay.
And I had in 2012 helped arrange that the weaving studio in Sweden that make my big work tapestries, she had taken it over, and she was 25 years old, and she was able to take over this studio and had helped keep them alive for 30 years because they needed my American commissions to keep going. Mm-hmm. And so I had my yarn all spun and dyed in Sweden from the Swedish sheep. And so for 41 years, I went 1 week every year to dye and spin yarn that I wanted.
Wow.
So that was a long, long relationship with one family. I worked with 8 members of that family. And sadly, they hit a bankruptcy, unfortunately, in 2018. And they sort of trying to get started again, but mm-hmm. It's very tricky to run a family business that depends on this high labor of spinning and dyeing. Mm-hmm. And so mostly just spinning and dyeing. Mm-hmm. And my goal was always to make sure that I paid Swedish wages for what I needed. I didn't want to fly to China and get it for cheap.
Yeah,
I wanted to retain my connection with Sweden and help them survive.
Right.
And I did.
Yeah.
I was an important person through several decades.
Yeah. Sweden also, I mean, obviously in so many ways plays a part in your work. So in that way, in the actual wool. So I'm interested in amazing, the Hudson Yards, amazing, amazing.
Yeah. Mind you, I had already worked with the same client for the Time Warner Center.
Okay.
He's the only one I've come across who buys more than one and switches them around. I mean, he's very cool that way.
Okay.
I mean, nobody has asked for that. But at the Time Warner Center, we don't have it in the ceiling, but he has the 4 seasons of Central Park. And every 3 months, they rotate.
They rotate.
Yeah.
So what's it like for you to have your art, to have your work in places like this? And again, let's maybe kind of think about, like you said, everyone starts with carpets, right?
Yeah.
What's it like to go from these personal textiles, these warmer, personal, familial textiles, to larger works? How does that work for you as an artist?
Well, it's the kind of artist I am. It has to fit the space.
Yeah.
So my imagination for what it should be in that space is always been very important. And of course, I haven't done carpets for public spaces, but it so happened that Frida, my young Swedish, she got to weave 3 huge carpets for a foundation in Minneapolis called the Margaret Cargill Foundation. And they were enlarging on their facilities. And Margaret Cargill had been interested in weaving. And she was a remarkable heiress of a large, large fortune. And this is all through the American Swedish Institute in Minneapolis. They are very active institution, and I have been close to them for years, and I've shown there. I showed a big exhibition there mm-hmm. in 2012 mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. when they reopened. They had added, and Margaret Cargill's the representative. Margaret Cargill was always anonymous. Until she died, nobody knew who she was. She was always referred to as the anonymous benefactress. You always had to say that.
until she was gone, and then the name.
And then it came out, and it became Minnesota's biggest foundation. It's the 26th biggest. You know what? She supported the building of the American Indian Museum on the Mall. That uh-huh. was one of the things she did uh-huh. anonymously.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
It is.
But to go back to carpets.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, so I did spend a lot of time on your website, and which is beautiful, and I loved watching the videos. You know, and one of the things that really got my interest was the section on paper. I love that the works exhibited in that section, the works that mm-hmm. you share in that section, are focused on a form, an art form, and a texture that mm-hmm. then you work with in another form and another texture.
Well, it's all part of trompe l'oeil, to fool the eye. So, and of course, famous painters have done, you know, they draw, yeah. it looks so real, you can't believe that it's yeah. not sticking out. Well, that's what I want to do too. Yeah. So, in that regard, I go totally against the grain at the Bauhaus, which, of course, I grew up with. And you weren't supposed to do perspectives in textiles. They were supposed to be flat, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But and I sort of was under that spell as long as I lived in Sweden. But after I moved to Canada, I said, forget that. I can do what I like here. and so I like pop art. So, you know, people thought back in Sweden that it was horrible to read photographs. I could do such a thing. It was terrible. But it was fresh and it was different. And I got to read that rainforest tree in Seattle that put me on the map, frankly, mm-hmm. that, in 1970.
Mm-hmm. That also brings me to another, and the video I love, the Trudeau-Nixon piece.
Yeah.
And also so interesting, your story about that, about taking the pieces apart.
Yeah, right. They're still apart.
And yeah. I wonder how you look at, I know that was an early 1969 or earlier. Mm-hmm. How do you see a piece like that with something like the Hudson Yards, the what is it called? Flowers and Maple Tree.
Flowers and Maple Tree, yes. Yeah. Yes. Of course, big nature scenes. The first really massive one I did was 400 square feet for a bank in Atlanta. And it is, I took that photograph at Callaway Gardens between Georgia and Alabama. It's this huge garden. And it's all azaleas and dogwood. And that piece was hanging. Here's how I think. As you walked into that lobby, you saw it at an angle. You saw it first at a 45-degree angle. So I was thinking, well, if you see it first that way, I'm going to squash it so that at 45 degrees, it looks right. So I did. I squashed the image and I moved the whole thing. And then I realized that it made it look more like spring because everything was sort of floating in, because I'd flattened it.
Yeah.
It made everything look like it was floating. And it looked more like spring. It's really peculiar.
Yeah.
I got for free, you know, I didn't think of it. But so I play with things, you know, I think of the space and I do what's right for the space. And that's why subject matter goes all over the map.
So I'm curious about this with the commissions and you're talking about, do you spend a lot of time in these spaces as you're working ahead of time? In order,
I certainly go and see it, and I used to be able to put my my little design in a three-dimensional mock-up. They used to build the scale model of the lobby before the internet, and then I could hang my thing in it and photograph it in the mock-up. But now we do it all on the internet.
Yeah.
insert the design into what the room looks like. Mm-hmm. So you see it on the screen, which of course is not the same as being in the space. But that's what we have sacrificed in these modern times. We don't see anything in three dimension anymore. We just see the screen, especially with the pandemic.
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
Yes, yes.
But I'm geared to think three-dimensionally, so you know, I don't forget about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been such a challenge to weave also within focus and out of focus. That's something I picked up on in 78 when I did the poppies. I realized that was made it even more interesting. If the photograph had that effect, I could weave that effect.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I've done that quite a bit.
Yeah. You mentioned the pandemic, and I am curious, since it seems like such a vital central part of your work is collaboration. And of course, yes, we have the internet, but what is collaboration like for you in this past year, or how has this unusual time affected projects you're working on or your work?
Well, the truth of the matter is when Hudson Yards was completed, which was last fall, I had no more commissions lined up. And that commission was so extraordinary. First of all, it lasted 4 years. And the hour and May brought in all kinds of stitchers. We had to figure out this whole ceiling business. And it's 45,000 stitches to attach the structure to the tapestry without showing at all when you look up on it. It's totally flat. Right. So they had to sew lots of small stitches so that the two layers were totally comfortable together. Nothing was pulled. And I wasn't involved in that personally because they sat here and stitched. She planned, you know, 3 days a week, they would stream in these people. Sometimes there were two, sometimes four. And we had so much fun. And that was fortunately before the pandemic.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in Sweden, they're weaving the tapestries. So one panel for the wall took 1 year. The ceiling took another year. The wall pen took another year, and then took another year.
Mm-hmm.
And so the timing was planned to be that. It was a 4-year commission.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got started in 2016. So by the time they started to move into the building, we had done the tap. The first one was done.
That's amazing and fortunate.
Yes. Yeah. But now, unfortunately, Hudson Yards has hit the hard times.
Yes.
Because of the pandemic. You know, they were building a whole, not just one building, it's a collection of, it's like a little neighborhood.
Right.
And they had added lots of restaurants and lots of, you know, entertaining things and shopping, and then all that stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. They were supposed to build one other half on the other side of 11th Avenue down to 12th Avenue. But they may not even do that because the finances have just fallen through the floor.
Sure, sure. Yeah, like everything. Yeah.
So we don't even know if the owner is going to move into this lobby. Eventually, the idea was that he wanted to see these tapestries every day. It was for himself that he bought them. And hopefully he'll. But, you know, one can understand if he stays up by Columbus Circle, where everything isn't a construction site.
That was Colette Laboeuf talking about tapestry work with textile artist Helena Hernmark. Let's take a break. When we're back, more from Hernmark. Playing now, French artist Pomme. Stay with us.
Je me souviens de ta voix. Des grands sapins. Et du froid. Te rappelles-tu des fois où tu m'as blessé de tes bras pour un rien. Je te fuyais au travers des murs. Tu Je te pardonne. Je sais, c'est contre toi que tu te pardonne. Je sais, c'était pas moi.
This is TCA Radio Hour. I'm Elise. Today we are listening to a conversation that Helena Hernmark, an internationally recognized artist, and Colette Laboeuf, TCA's executive director, had this March. Helena Hernmark grew up in Sweden and moved to the United States in the mid-70s. Her tapestry work can be seen in museums, touring exhibitions, as well as public and private locations around the world. She brings an artistic depth to a diversity of spaces, using wool to paint pictures that one might not expect in a tapestry. She tells Colette Laboeuf about her approach of weaving that associates an acute sense of space, an agile technique, and an intimate look onto the unique wool texture.
So what are you working on now?
Well, now you see, I had started in on deciding to weave something for my own pleasure, and I took forever to decide between four designs which one it was going to be. And I have started it. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that a group in Sweden are working on giving us an exhibition. So we have Zoom with them tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They have to find the venue and the financing, this mm-hmm. team. But they're very eager to do it, to do a really good show about how Frida and I have worked together, the whole package.
Right.
To how it works and how we think and how we design and mm-hmm. what is important. And she's trying to sustain this business now into the future. So it's not a matter of just selling textiles, hand-woven textiles. It's also a matter of developing a knowledge base so that people can come and study there, that academic people can come and focus on different.
Yeah, on a tradition and a history also.
Yes. So, and she has all the archives going back to the 30s. I mean, and she's going to work with that too. So that's part of her business profile. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of young people who are weaving now. But of course, it's a little hard for her to compete with the person who sits at home because of the sales tax rules. If you have a business, you have to add 25% on what you're selling. And the artist gets only to pay 12%. And I don't know if she can get around that. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just one problem.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But she has a dedicated, the church, as I say, is still buying from her. She just made one more carpet for another church. And they do some carpets that are shuttled, so they are cheaper. It's a pattern that was designed. But it was my mentor. The reason it's all that I'm involved is that my father took me to this very place when I was 17 to show me, you know, this is how some people live. And I said to myself, this is how I'm going to live. Immediate decision. And so she became my mentor, Alice Lund.
So you knew this right away?
Right away I knew it.
Really? Yeah. What did you think before your father took you there? What were you thinking?
Well, it's a little complicated because we were four children, but my parents divorced and my mother had married in England and I was the one who moved to England for 3 years. So I was going to English schools, trying to decide what to do. And it was going to be either journalism or textiles. If it was going to be textiles, then I was going to go back to Sweden for my education in Sweden. And mm-hmm. by then my father had taken me there. So the decision was made. My mother was a journalist. So. But she was a Swedish journalist, so after she moved to England, she wasn't able to be really professional because her English wasn't as good as her Swedish.
Mm-hmm.
So she regretted that in a way, I think.
So you remember going in this space and saying, what struck you when you said, okay, yes, I'm going to do this?
Well, it was nice three-story wooden building that had mm-hmm. been renovated to fit. So on the ground floor is the office and the weaving studio. And there were 19 weavers in those days who they could live on their salaries they got for hand weaving.
Because wow. That was
the world changed in the textile industry has changed so dramatically. And the first competition came from Poland, cheaper labor in Poland. Mm-hmm. And then it went from there. So when I started in that, when I gave them my first commission in 1975, there were like four people. And then it became just two. And it's been just two weavers since then.
Wow.
But they have, one has left, retired, and the young one has joined. So that's what we hope to do, that the young ones can build up that knowledge, because the one who's still there, Ebba, who's 64, I think, she knows everything, how every technique, ever. She really knows so many different things that they did over the years. It wasn't just one way of weaving or one technique. My technique was the oddball, and it was hard to learn. So the two who learned my technique would always weave my stuff.
Mm-hmm. How do you talk about your technique to non-weavers? I mean,
well, non-weavers, you have to say, well, there's a warp and there's a weft. Other weavers, I can say that if I compare it to the gobelin technique, the tradition, which I often do, and I started out thinking about the gobelin technique and how to earn my living, I said to myself, I've got to be able to weave 1 square meter a week. Then I can price it at a price that people will pay. Mm-hmm. And so then I realized, okay, gobelin technique, I have to be 3 times faster. Mm-hmm. I have to coarsen it up and simply figure a way to go faster. And that's how I based, that's how I started my business. Mm-hmm. And then I added more charges for the times when I didn't have any work. So you have to fill in the spaces. But that's how I did it. I mean, it's a very rudimentary way to start, but I never had a gallery, you see. Mm-hmm. And it never came my way in a natural way, that a really good gallery. And I can see why, because I didn't produce very much. Mm-hmm. One job or 2 jobs a year was plenty. And that was the charm. I didn't have to sit in meetings and talk to other people more than twice a year. Then they signed the contract, forget it. Then go home and weave and enjoy it. So that was a very important decision, that you know, I like to have people around me, but I don't want to do office work. Well, of course, in the end, I had to do my own office work. And I started keeping charts on everything. So I have a tremendous amount of charts, figuring out how long things took, and you know, who wove on them, and the months, and the money, and the always juggling in my head dollars to kroner and square feet to square meters. Mm-hmm. So I had to do those calculations all the time. Because,
right.
And I enjoyed doing that. So I have on paper all these strange charts where I wrote every day how much we wove when I had weavers here, because for many years I hired weavers here in America, one or two people. Mm-hmm. Who were on the loom with me, who had to learn the technique. And the one who did it the best has become a painter, and she's a great painter. Mm-hmm. And she says she's a great painter because she learned to weave and mix colors here.
So interesting.
Yes.
And do you feel that that's true? I mean, in this case of the artist you mentioned, it's you know, that she makes that connection. What do you think artists who work in other disciplines get from weaving also? What is gained? Is it about color? Is it about texture? Oh. Yeah.
To me, it's mostly about that how the light is absorbed by the wool. Most other art has some shiny surface. And that's like, then it's not immediate. Then it doesn't feel, you know, close to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge important point. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it helps with the acoustics. And also, my selling point was always, if you have one tapestry in the lobby, that's all you need. You don't need any furniture or plants or anything. The tapestry does it all.
It does everything.
Yes, because it makes you realize, okay, you've stepped into a special space.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a tapestry.
Yeah.
So, but now, I mean, most architects, the lobbies are barren. They're huge, barren places. And I keep thinking, why don't they buy tapestries?
And what do you think that's about? Is that just like a sign of the times for architecture, ways of people being in space?
Maybe the last 30 or 40 years, architecture has not embraced. The need is there, but they don't make use of it. And it has to do with, my success had to do with the fact that when I went to see architects, in the 60s, they all had learned about Scandinavian design. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Scandinavian design was a big deal, even before World War II. Mm-hmm. And there's an exhibition recently created that's going to travel now on the subject. Mm-hmm. All techniques, all kind of design. Mm-hmm. But of course, weavers are part of that. Mm-hmm. So you always, if you did a decent building and a lobby, then it in Sweden, they use textiles a lot for the lobbies. Mm-hmm. But it fell away too. I noticed that the Swedish State Commission for the Arts would commission them all the time. But they had no money for maintenance and no money to photograph it when it was new.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That means that a lot of stuff has been lost and is forgotten.
Because it wasn't cared for or documented.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm just curious about the practicality of that. Is that something also part of when you do a commission? Is that also something you're thinking of, is how will it be cared for? And is
yeah.
that, yeah.
Yeah. And on the whole, the answer is no. Unfortunately, and then they get thrown away or lost at the end.
But that must just be awful.
Well, yes and no. I've lost some real gems, but recently we have had two fantastic pieces returned to us as a gift.
Oh, good.
We're thrilled. One was done for Bethlehem Steel Corporation, and the other one was done for PepsiCo World Beverages. And they managed to lose two huge rolls of tapestries for 12 years. They were forgotten in a closet and nobody knew where they were or what it was.
How is that possible?
It's possible, I can tell you. So the guy who had looked at them in 2013 and not recognized what they were, in 2020, he same guy was still there. He recognized the rolls the second time. Go figure.
That's amazing.
They're unhurt. They're beautiful. One of them is now in Europe, is going to tour for 2 years in Europe in a group exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at my stage now, because I'm going to turn 80 soon, I'm not so actively looking for new work. It's mostly do what you enjoy and participate mm-hmm. in shows, by all means, and work on the archives with May. I mean, she is working on the archives. Mm-hmm. And also, we're just getting moving on my husband's archives. So I've had this responsibility to take care of him too. He didn't care a bit about what happened to it, but he was important enough not to. So we're splitting his stuff between Cooper Hewitt and UMN. Mm-hmm. All of my stuff goes to UMN eventually.
Uh-huh.
We already have a lot of my pieces, as you know.
Yes, absolutely. In your work on your archive, is this writing about the work that you've done also?
Partly. Well, one thing May has done is we've gone through and I have recorded what I remember about every piece.
Oh, that's great.
It's an oral history. And then she typed it out and then she has added a chapter in each of these sets that we did. I would talk about three or four pieces at the same time. And then she would list what we are referring to and where they've been exhibited and the whole list of what happened to them. And so that's a real document to start. And she has in her mind eventually a catalogue raisonné. And I do have great photographs of everything because I made sure I photographed everything when it was newly installed.
Wonderful.
And I knew that I had to charge more to afford that because I had four photographers in the US who would cover the different areas.
Uh-huh.
So one in Chicago, one in Atlanta, one in San Francisco. And I'll send them around to photograph whatever is near mm-hmm. where they are. But in the early days, it was every new job got photographed. So, no, that's a treasure. I have it. It's all on 4x5s, of course, but, you know, you can...
But you have it.
With the paper born stuff anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to go back to to carpets.
Yeah.
My home, yes. I have hand-woven carpets in every room of my house because to me that's a perfectly natural and normal thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You have a hardwood floor and then you put wool carpets on them. I don't weave rag rugs. A lot of people weave rag rugs, which is nice too. Those long runners. Mine are in wool and composed to fit a certain space.
And they're yours.
They're mine. And it's what I use. I mean, that's what I wouldn't give them, and I needed a carpet on the floor. I made it.
Right.
But I had this wonderful helper for 24 years, a Chinese woman who came to America in 83 with her husband, and some of her family already lived here. She didn't speak English. She wasn't trained in anything. And she took care of us here in the studio for 24 years. And she did learn my technique, but not very fast. Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to do it, nothing the speed with which you can, how fast can you make up your mind? It's slow to weave, but most of the time is spent trying to decide. You think that putting the yarn through the warp and everything takes time. And of course it does, but it's a decision-making that decides how fast or slow it is. Mm-hmm. Now, some days you can't make up your mind, so you don't get anywhere. And some days it goes like a charm. Because it's so tricky all the time, it is a slow process. So that big tapestry for Atlanta was woven in 3 sections, and it took 13 months for 3 weavers to make it.
That was Helena Hernmark talking with Colette Laboeuf. More from her when we come back. But first, let's listen to a song from Palm, the Sequoia. Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. Today, our guest is Helena Hernmark. Hernmark is a fiber artist and renowned weaver whose work is exhibited around the world. You can find some pictures on her website, hernmark.com. She shares today her passion for her art and the intimate place it holds in her life as a slow practice that allows for physical involvement and creative vision.
You teach people how to do what you do also. Is that formal or is that, how does that work? How do people learn from you?
It's not formal. I have no degree, so I couldn't teach in the university system. So it was workshops.
Okay.
Now, I had one. I had actually started a little bit, been invited to RISD to do winter sessions. Twice I did that, 6 weeks, with the students who were not taking textiles. So that was fun. It was all the others. And they wove a little square, some design. I helped them design and so on. So that was my first experience. And then I was at Haystack one summer for 3 weeks. They used to have 3-week sessions. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of fun. And I tried to teach my technique, but it's difficult. So, it's not, they don't get. So then I was invited to come to Sweden. And there I did it for 4 times at one craft school called Setter Glentan. And some people came back several times, and that helped them. Mm-hmm. And then the last 2 were at Frida's studio. We borrowed looms and had 12 people. But at that point, I realized that I was so allergic to the wool dust that I had to stop.
Really?
Because when many of them sit and beat on looms in a room with a low ceiling, I got sick.
Oh, yeah.
So that was it. So about 50 people maybe learned from me. And in Sweden, it's remarkable. They didn't know each other. They were from all over Sweden. But they started to have a show together once a year. So everyone didn't participate, but some would, and they would pick a town, a bit like Convergence. And mm-hmm. then the group that lived near that town would organize it, and then they would get together and have an exhibition, even print a catalog and thing.
How wonderful.
And they've done that every year since. Mm-hmm. And they came here to Connecticut. It was funny to have 30 Swedes in my garden all at once. And we were also in Minneapolis in 2012. Mm-hmm. They all came to Minneapolis and with their families. So you think, this is fascinating, all these plane tickets that I bought because of me teaching. And I think it's like a snowball rolling. It gets bigger and bigger. It's kind of nice.
But that's beautiful.
Yeah. And one of them has turned out to be a real artist. So mm-hmm. that's what you want. You want out of 50, that's great. And she's wonderful. And she has 6 children. And it was just the right time for her. The last kid was getting up in school, and mm-hmm. she couldn't have the time.
It was the right time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Now we're both in the same exhibition traveling in Europe.
So I saw, on your website, I saw there's an mm-hmm. exhibition right now.
Yeah. Art Textile in Denmark. And it's a fantastic woman. I also taught, she brought me to Denmark 1 year to teach Danes who spoke neither Swedish nor English. So that was funny. she has started something called the European Tapestry Forum. Mm-hmm. And if you live in Europe, you can participate in her exhibitions every year. So here's a woman who is her own artist and weaves fantastic in gobelin. She has a loom that's ancient. Her beam is like an ancient tree that's hundreds of years old. It's fantastic. And she takes the time not only to do her own work, but to run this whole thing, to keep the whole group. And not only that, she finds money for the exhibitions and she translates to English in the catalog. to me, she's here.
She sounds hero. Like a powerhouse.
She's a power. She's absolutely wonderful. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I'm so happy to be invited.
So that show goes to different places in Europe.
Yeah. And just to find the venues. Now, for example, it's in Denmark first. It's on now. But the next, it goes to Finland. But she couldn't pin anyone down for the summer. So it all has to be stored somewhere for the summer. And then she goes to, but she may find other venues. And she's mm-hmm. been successful. And, she's shown at some great places around Europe, old castles in Austria. Or it's really good stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
So this world of textiles is very big and very fun.
It sounds huge. It sounds vibrant. And yeah. I mean, what I love reading about, like on your website, reading about your work, and it's just this link between what is so relevant now, but also tradition, mm-hmm. history, technique, this wonderful combination of things that make it important.
And it's slow work with your hands. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs more of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's so true, because it's the time you forget yourself.
Right.
And the hours go flying by. You're just enjoying what you're doing.
In that moment.
Yeah.
You're for hours.
Yeah. It's great. Yeah. I would never have wanted it any other way, I must say. Yeah. But now I say with a sort of grin, because there was a time when it was very unpopular in Sweden too. It just dropped. Dropped. Because it was when they started in on critical thinking, and they also brought in the American university system in the higher education. Mm-hmm. And that meant they dropped the crafts as if they didn't exist.
Right.
They stopped using the word for it.
Right. And just wanted to talk about theory.
Yeah, right. Where do you get all that? So what I say now is if you live long enough, you can ride the wave twice. The interest has grown tremendously lately.
Yeah. And do you think that's about you know, do you think that's also about people really wanting to connect to, like you said, something slow? Also,
well, yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's mostly the experience of doing it. Selling them is still a tough call.
Right.
It's a very tough call.
Right.
Because nobody normal can compensate you for the time.
Sure.
But some people, and also people not used to hanging textiles on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's a tradition in Sweden. And all the Vikings did it, and everybody did it, mm-hmm. to keep the places warm and cozy. And then the symbolism of the designs and everything. And of course, in the rest of the world, everyone was doing textiles. Indonesia, I mean, African textiles are the most amazing, the Kuba people. I mean, it's such a rich, rich history. So it's odd to me that some people are totally uninterested in it.
I know.
They only look in the sculpture. and that's the case of the auction houses. So the secondhand value is not there.
Well, this has just been so wonderful to talk with you. I feel like I want to just go and do something, really immerse myself in something. I don't know how to weave, but maybe I'll read.
Yeah, well, that's right. Anything. Reading is, of course, wonderful. You know, one, you know, just something I played with recently, so typical accidental thing. I was going through family letters and I realized that I had duplicates of the letters from my mother. So I started shredding them. So I shredded away and shredded away. And then after a while, I looked at the heap of shreds. And my God, that's interesting. So I've woven with the shreds. And some of them got sliced across the word and some along the words. So here and there in these threads, you can read like something she's saying, and sometimes you don't. So I've woven a little tapestry.
Like I'm getting the image of like a crossword puzzle almost.
Yes, almost, yes. And then you can crunch it together. I have it hanging right here.
Oh, wow. How does that work with the...
It's like it's weft. Instead of a thread, I just put in strips of this. And then now and then I have a thread going all the way through to hold it together. But otherwise, and then the paper sticks out where it ends because they're not very long, these strips. But up here, you can see words written.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and that's my mother writing. So, you know, that means something.
Exactly. And then I love it. And it
doesn't weigh anything.
Uh-huh.
And I wove it on a Mirix loom, one of those little looms that you have on a table.
Mm-hmm.
So it's portable.
And the paper doesn't fall apart as you're doing this.
No.
No.
No, because it's copy paper. It's you can cut it easily now. But
right. That is really neat.
Strong too.
So you just shredded everything and then you looked at it and said, wait.
And then I also have photographed it and I've gone in on a real detail and I'm thinking about weaving how it looked, blowing it up. Yeah.
Again, the paper.
Yeah, that's right. After the one I'm doing is a scene from a wedding in Tuscany. So it's a little different, but it's a very atmosphere because it's at the end of the party, it's gotten dark, and the staff, the guys who've served, are sort of standing around smoking in the back in front of a brick wall in their white coats, and everything is a little fuzzy and out of focus, and there's some bottles standing there, and that's what it is. It's a nice picture. So very hard to weave because it's so suggestive of just feeling the light, the way the light is playing on it.
So the tone.
But it'll be something. Yeah, it'll be great.
Yeah, wonderful.
That was Helena Hernmark talking with Colette Laboeuf. Hernmark's work can be seen online at hernmark.com. You're listening to TCA Radio Hour. We'll take a quick musical break with Palm before shifting our focus to current challenges in the cultural world.
Thank you.
place que l'on retiendra. Les mots de velours confiés au silence, les failles de ces jours où l'amour s'avance. Prenons le temps qu'il faut pour laisser passer les cours d'eau jusqu'au dernier bateau. On prendra celui qu'il nous faut. S'il te blesse les feux de joie, de sagesse, on les couvrira. Brouiller les contours de nos armes blanches, la nuit, les bruits sourds d'un amour qui danse. Prenons le temps qu'il faut pour laisser passer les cours d'eau jusqu'au dernier bateau. On prendra celui qu'il nous faut.
You're listening to TCA Radio Hour. Let's focus our attention to some news in the art and cultural world. Late March, the University of Aberdeen in Scotland became the first European institution to announce the repatriation of Benin bronzes. These artifacts were looted from Benin, a country today known as Nigeria. More than 1,000 of metal sculptures and plaques decorated the Royal Palace of Benin when colonists arrived in the late 19th century and stole them. The announcement of repatriation of one of the bronzes is an unprecedented move to recognize the difficult history of some museum collections and address it. In 2018, French President Macron requested a report to address the presence of historically stolen objects in European collections. This report came in the context of more and more voices from African countries expressing the need for their artifacts to be returned. According to Reuters, some 90% of Africa's cultural heritage is now believed to be in Europe. The 2018 report states that the Quai Branly Museum in Paris alone holds some 70,000 African objects, as does London's British Museum. Several European institutions have offered to loan the artwork to their home countries so they can be displayed there. But Ethiopia and Greece, amongst other countries, are refusing to borrow their own heritage. African countries are not the only ones facing the challenge of regaining rights to their heritage, with all colonized nations subject to this immense difficulty. Most recently, in February, the Association of American Indian Affairs, a nonprofit that advocates for Native community rights, addressed an open letter to the Harvard Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology. The AAIA accused the museum of lengthy processes that forbid a quick repatriation of ancestral remains and burial artifacts. Under American law, such artifacts and human remains should be returned to their native nations. Since 1990, museums have been working under this law, but the nonprofit pointed out that only 18% of Harvard's collections have been repatriated after 30 years of work. This is an ongoing issue that too many communities, while dealing with consequences of colonization, still have to fight for. While archaeological research is important to understand humans' history, this is a matter of human rights and social justice, states AAIA in their open letter. The letter is accessible online on the Association of American Indian Affairs website. That's it for the art news. This was TCA Radio Hour. TCA Radio Hour is brought to you with generous support from this station, KNC 93.5 FM, streaming live at truthouseradio.com, and our local business partner, Taos Lifestyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Be well. Playing now, a last tune from Pomme, Anxiété.
Je suis
comprendra comment y faire. Je suis elle qu'on ne voit pas. Je suis elle qu'on n'entend pas. Je suis cachée. Je suis.